Blog Talk Radio.
Michael Tellinger, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you. You have written a couple of fantastic books. We're going to talk about both of them, African Temples of the Anunnaki and Slave Species of the Gods. So let's get right into it. I have been reading with fascination African Temples of the Anunnaki, and I have to ask you this. When did you begin to make the connection with Zechariah Sitchin's work and the 12th planet? What was the motivation? I mean, did Sitchin come first and then you discovered these ruins, or were you out in the field and all of a sudden you ran into some of these ruins and you thought, this is very odd? Where's the connection there?
Yeah, thanks, Cliff. Nice to be talking to you. What's really interesting about this is that it is a journey, you know, and most people that have found a life path and a journey in their life that has some sort of meaning and purpose to them will understand what I'm talking about. There are millions of people that are still searching for their path and their journey, and then suddenly when you find it, it's like everything just fits and clicks in and falls into place. And writing Slave Species of God, the original version of it in 2005, that was then released, republished by Bear & Co. Inner Traditions, and retitled to Slave Species of the Gods, mm-hmm. which I guess is more appropriate, but I originally gave it Slave Species of God with a small g, just to be provocative.
Okay.
Yeah, and it did work, but I guess the timing was right when Inner Traditions took over the publishing worldwide. A few years ago now, and they're doing a splendid job. So well done to them. To answer your question is, you know, I started reading Sitchin in about 1990. Mm-hmm. I discovered Zechariah Sitchin when I was 30 years old, and he just completely blew my mind. At that time, I was already obviously reading, you know, all the other authors in that field, and I was well aware of the alternative knowledge pool and having come out of and the alternative sciences and so forth, and having come out of medical school at Wits University in Johannesburg, I spent 5 years at medical school studying pharmaceutics. I was very very clear in my understanding that what I was taught was not necessarily the whole truth. And in fact, much of what I was taught, I started to suspect was very far from the truth and the reality. And so I started really looking at it from a perspective of the genetics. The whole DNA thing was where I was interested in. Mm-hmm. And the fact that our DNA seems to be a manipulated and a messed with structure in our body. And that's what drove me, and I started looking at Sitchin's work and started connecting it to the other ancient texts, you know, from the East and all kinds of ancient writings that I could lay my hands on, and started to realize that all of that stuff was supporting one another. All the ancient texts actually support each other in the information they carry. Mm-hmm. And so do all ancient cultures and civilizations. I have not yet come across anyone that says, other than, you know, we come from the stars. All ancient cultures and civilizations keep telling us and reminding us that we come from the stars. And so that was really the driving factor for me to sit down and what I found actually is I was a bit frustrated after reading all of Sitchin and you know, Graham Hancock and all the other books, you know, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. A lot of them are very complex, very difficult books to read.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They carry a lot of heavy information, and yet I found there wasn't enough scientific connection and genetic connection to some of the arguments. So that's really what my motivation was, is to pull together put together a book that contains a lot of the archaeological and ancient texts information, including biblical and Hebrew and Quran and all the other ancient cultures, mm-hmm. but weave into it a scientific component that nobody could challenge because it was based on the latest scientific knowledge and information. And I guess it somehow succeeded because the book still sells and seems to sell more every year.
Mm. You know, I want to work with the most recent book, and I do want to cover Slave Species because it's a fascinating book. But in African Temples, you literally, along with an associate, have photographed just literally tons of these ruins from the ground and from the air. And in them, it seems like they're continually educating you, not just the stone circles themselves, but as an example, you state that most of these sites have no doors, and they appear to be energy centers or power plants of some kind. How did you detect that they were power plants or energy centers? Did you take readings of the facilities with some kind of sensitive devices, or... How did you make that distinction?
Yeah, Cliff, it was readings. But before the readings began, first, you know, you have to, your suspicion or your, something has to be aroused for you to go that route.
Yeah.
You know, you don't walk into a thing and say, "Oh, I better take electronic and scientific measurements here to see if there are frequencies and electromagnetic field." You know, you just don't think like that, because all history books, all archaeological books that refer to these structures in Southern Africa, these thousands of stone ruins, until I came along, they thought there were thousands of them, and then I came along and shattered that myth. But you know, all of the history books up until the time that I started getting involved here in it, which was in 2007, kept repeating and telling us that there were cattle enclosures, or as we call cattle kraal here in South Africa, and or dwellings that were built by migrating tribes. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't one of those, then it was either one of them. So the fact that some of the archaeological books that were written, or the surveys, the archaeological surveys, that's the word I was looking for, that I found from the 1939 survey, which is a really critical one, from the Bloemfontein University and Museum, mm-hmm. in Bloemfontein, one of the capitals in South Africa, the capital of the Orange Free State province, and 1939, and already then they made some startling statements and reached some conclusions that raise serious eyebrows to anyone who has a scientific mind. And they say in their evaluation that the original structures, the original stone circles, had no doors and entrances, and then they leave it there.
Wow.
It's like, well, surely when you make a statement like that, you have to reach one immediate and instant conclusion. If they have no doors and entrances, then they cannot be dwellings for cows nor humans. You know, and
right.
And that it completely blew my mind that what many people would perceive to be smart and clever and intelligent and educated people have no scientific deductive powers or any kind of logic for that matter by the looks of it.
It is strange,
and,
yeah.
And remember that the fascination with these stone circles in South Africa, and I need to come back to also to connect the dots what I started talking about, slave species of God or slave species of the gods, and how I ran into doing the research on the stone ruins. But it's important to know that the fascination with the stone ruins of Southern Africa go back 500 years. It's not something new. This has been going on for 500 years, from the late 1400s, from 1495 around there to the really main, first real detailed records, written records by the Portuguese explorers when they came down around the Cape of Good Hope, mm-hmm. From Europe towards India, and they came onto the land and they came across these ancient people here. And they found all these ancient ruins, or these ruins, and when they asked the people who built these ruins, they were told, "We don't know." Hmm. Now think about this. This is 500 years ago. And the interesting thing is, this is the fascinating thing. 500 years ago, the Portuguese explorers were told by the native population of Southern Africa that they did not know who built these structures. And yet, all our current history books date these stone structures no older than 500 years.
Hmm.
Isn't that a strange coincidence?
Yes.
It's like the one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing.
Well, let me just interrupt you real quickly on that. Now, are you saying that no one in 500 years until you came along had thought that these structures were a lost civilization, or they had any properties that needed to be inspected beyond archaeological evidence? In other words, they didn't do any testing electronically or with any of the early devices to see if there was any kind of magnetic properties?
It seems like that is the case. It seems like I was the first person to break that thought pattern, to think outside the box and to say, hold on, these are not dwellings for people nor cows. So what are they? And that's when it started to just snowball, and that's when the knowledge and information, it was just like I tapped into the main artery of the morphogenetic field of knowledge and information out there.
Wow.
And it just came downloading every day. I would just get more and more information.
So
literally
so in that early study that you reference, I think it was it, what year was that early study on the facility, on the various ruins? It was like in the
1939.
Right.
Yeah.
They're more in line to do some field study on various ruins.
Typical archaeological study, Cliff. And again, for people that don't know this, just keep this in mind. Historians and archaeologists are not scientists in the scientific sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they do not think like scientists do. They are trained like historians, and they're trained like archaeologists to dig holes and catalog things that they find and try and fit them to other pieces that they find. They don't think the way that a true scientist would think in terms of physics, chemistry, astronomy, quantum physics, genetics, biology, zoology, whatever you want to call it, soil science. I mean, the number of scientists that I've dealt with since I started here is, I can't even remember. As I'm talking, all these memories come flooding back of 7 or nearly 8 years of research, and incredible people and scientists that are really out of the box thinkers that I've met, from geologists to soil scientists and electromagnetic experts to astronomers and archaeoastronomers and geophysicists and geneticists, and so it goes. So
Yeah. So, and these are the individuals who are really making headway, like Chris Dunn and Robert Schock, geologist, and like yourself, yeah, people who are saying, look at it this way, look at it this way. Let's talk a little bit about what you found. In your book, you uncovered a science that's somewhat imbued in stone. That's why I'm going to say about it. And you reference Tesla, Reif, and Keeley as early pioneers who understood the Earth had this innate energy, and the Anunnaki brought a lot of this knowledge to Earth, and it's built into these structures. Can you talk a little bit about some of the discoveries you made around this energy and how it may have influenced not only the building of these complexes, but a whole society?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to connect the dots from an earlier question you posed. You know, how did I start to research it, and why did this come about?
Sure.
And that's very simply because I just released Slave Species of God, Slave Species of the Gods, and I was doing a lecture on it in Pretoria, one of the cities in South Africa, and a guy came to my presentation, and afterwards he thought I was an American author. He didn't even know I was a South African. And afterwards he said to me, listen, can I show you some photographs of some interesting ruins in South Africa? And I said, sure, I'd love to. And he whipped out a laptop and started showing me these aerial photographs. This was in early 2007. And this was Jan Heiner. And I just took one look. He must have shown me like 10 pictures. And by the time he carried on, I instinctively and just instantly knew that somehow these structures are connected to what I was writing about in Slave Species of the Gods and the Anunnaki and very, very ancient activity in Southern Africa. And it just completely, I became obsessed with it. And then I lost contact with Jan after that. For about 6 months, I lost contact with him. And it was like by divine providence, I tell you. It was unbelievable. I was at home and I was writing and working on more research to add to future versions of Slave Species of the Gods. And I was thinking, I need to get hold of that guy that showed me those pictures. And I had no idea how to get hold of him. And I was trying to find the guest list from that talk about 6 months ago. And as I was looking for the guest list and his name and his contact details, an email came in. It was from his PA. And it said, hi, Michael, Jan Heiner would love to meet up with you and show you the ruins. And it was like, it was just incredible. I was busy looking for his number and an email from him came in. So we had obviously were destined to meet and to take this further. So needless to say, within a week or two, I went down to what we call the Lowveld, closer to Mozambique in a town called Nelspruit, where is very close to where I live right now. Mm-hmm. We spent 2 days flying around in a helicopter looking at the ruins. And I was just astounded. It completely changed my perspective of Southern Africa and its importance and the role it plays in the ancient history of humankind. Because until that time, we were always told that Southern Africa has very little to do other than the cradle of humankind, and then the people left here and then they settled all over the world, and that's when they really started doing amazing things, you know? Right. Because we're always told, and all the history books always reduce Southern Africa to this place that nothing ever happened. And you know what? Once you start understanding who runs the world, who's really behind the control of this planet and the agenda behind their activities, it starts to make complete sense why that story is spun and taught to us.
Okay.
Because if people knew the importance of Southern Africa and this vast vanished civilization, which I've now discovered, that changes everything about, you know, who we are as a species, where we come from, where a lot of this early activity among humanity was going on, and the fact that it was all about gold. All to do with gold, and, you know, my latest research points out to a lot more than that, but gold was certainly the central theme and one of the main reasons why all this activity was going on here in Southern Africa. So that's in a nutshell how it went from Slave Species of the Gods to writing about the stone ruins, which also obviously my first book about that includes, which is Adam's Calendar. Adam's Calendar was not released by Bear & Co., but it is available in the USA through a different distributor. And Adam's Calendar is really what Johann Heine discovered and rediscovered in 2003. Mm-hmm. He didn't discover it. He rediscovered it. It was an ancient structure well known to the African shaman and knowledge keepers for thousands of years.
Right, right.
And still today, even after all the research, all the remarkable scientific proof that I've presented in books and lectures, the universities and the mainstream archaeological historical societies and universities will not touch it. They refuse to have anything to do with it. And it's almost like their silence is now becoming deafening, you know, because they object too much now.
Interesting. That happens with a lot of other ancient sites too, is the evidence from alternative research groups, people who are not mainstream archaeologists or Egyptologists, when claims are made. As a good example, Chris Dunn's work with machining, ancient machining tools,
yes.
The mainstream doesn't touch his work, and yet programs like Ancient Aliens and other history channels refer to his work constantly without giving him credit, which drives him nuts.
Yep.
But
you know, the funny part is I'm a graduate of Wits University. Wits University Medical School was for many years one of the finest medical schools in the world in the sort of dark apartheid years, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm a graduate from Wits Medical School, but now suddenly I'm outside of the academia, you know. It's like, well, you gave me a degree, but now when I make a discovery, I'm not good enough? What's going on here?
That is odd. That is odd. But can we circle back to some of your discoveries? Because I do want to bring up Adam's Calendar and talk a little bit about that. But I want to, you in the many of your latest writings, you discuss either it's an inner matrix in some of these stones that you have found, and their ability, and you don't actually describe. Or maybe I've missed it, but you don't actually describe information within the stones themselves. It's more of a sound frequency, and that's something that's somewhat new. Now in America, a researcher named John Burke has been he just passed away a few years ago, but he discovered in a lot of these American stone structures and the Maya structures that they understood the subtle energies of the earth. He called them telluric fields. And he actually believed, and I am believing now, that the Maya built on top of these natural emitting geomagnetic fields and were able to, through stone encapturing pyramids, channel that energy up and through their stone matrix. And we don't know what they did with this energy. We think that they were able to, at very early period, to channel that energy through a number of different methods. I'm interested to know what you discovered and how these energy fields were used.
Well, I think I actually provide the scientific evidence for that, not just, you know, theory.
Okay.
And that's where, this is why there's such a lot of attention from really leading scientists around the world, guys that are really like, you know, Nobel laureates and guys that are working in the electromagnetic fields and sound frequencies and resonance projects and research, because that's ultimately what it all comes down to. Everything in creation comes out of a source field of resonance and vibration and frequency. Everything. And this is why it's really very exciting for me right now, because we are really dealing with the fundamental laws of nature and getting very close to understanding all the foundations for the laws of nature. Everything that controls the periodic table, the elements, the the chemistry, the physics, everything seen and unseen in the universe, I have a much clearer understanding of it because of what I've learned from the stone circles. Mm-hmm. And this you know, sounds insane, but this is unfortunately the way that fortunately, I guess for me, the way that sometimes these things work, you know, the other way around. Not what you get taught at university. In fact, throw that all away and start learning from the other direction. Mm-hmm. And so just to support the telluric fields and the ley lines and all that, absolutely. And for the people that have seen some of my online presentations that are available, and there are many of them, I highly recommend you go and look at the two of them that are the Breakthrough Energy Conference in Hilversum, Holland, mm-hmm. and then the next year, the Breakthrough Energy Conference, the second year in Boulder, Colorado. And there I show a lot of this information and share a lot of the measurements and so forth with slides. And I show evidence that these ancient cultures were so far ahead of where we are today with their knowledge of the laws of nature and how to use the laws of nature as a source of energy on this planet, in this particular density, in this reality, in this frequency. And what they were doing with it becomes a really interesting additional chapter to this, to these discoveries. So the reason I say that I prove that they actually understood this is because of the measurements in the stone circles, the electronic measurements, the scientific measurements, electromagnetic fields and sound frequencies, and also specifically at Adam's calendar. And again, it is always a journey. You know, you don't go there and say, well, let's start measuring the stuff and see what we can find. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Certain things happen that make you go, oh my goodness, maybe we should measure this, or what's going on? Why is this happening? And the first thing we started to notice is not so much in the stone circles, because they are more subtle, but at Adam's calendar, the energies and the frequencies are so strong and so off the charts that I can tell you right now, I don't know of any other site, man-made or natural, on Earth right now, as we speak. In the most advanced military projects, wherever you may look, no place on Earth that generates such high sound frequencies as we find at Adam's calendar. Hmm. Now, that is mind-blowing, because it's supposed to be, you know, many, as I said, of these mainstream academics and universities in South Africa still, you know, they're not saying a word, but you know, it's still supposed to be a natural phenomenon. And you know, unfortunately, that our measurements blow this right out the water. Hmm. Because we measured at Adam's calendar, before I start telling you about the measurements, when we first started going there, Johan discovered it in 2003, and he spent 5 years on his own with no support from any of these universities or academics. On his own, he measured it and realized that it was aligned to the solstices and equinoxes, and that it actually works, still today, works like perfectly calibrated calendar. You can tell every day of the year by the, it's like a giant sundial, mm-hmm. Where the shadow of the shadow of the one rock cast upon the other falls from solstice to through the equinox to the other solstice, and it's spectacular. So it's still an accurate calendar, but it is now connected to many other things, like the rise of Orion. You know, then there's, so we find a Horus bird there, and then the plot starts to thicken, and then we find the pyramidal structures down in the valley that line up with the rise of Orion, and it just gets more and more bizarre. But the one thing we found when I first started going there and started to take tourists there, and this is in early 2008, the people started to display different reactions, physical reactions.
Ah, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and some people would go in there and just go, oh my God, I feel like I want to vomit, or I feel... I can't. And some people, in fact, we had this just recently. just recently we took a very famous group of people, I'm not going to mention any names, but a very famous group of American actors and soap opera stars and spiritual leaders to Adam's calendar. And one of the guys that was with them could not, he walked into this circular part, because there's no walls at Adam's calendar. There are no walls like you find at the stone circles. And yet, as you walk through that imaginary circle, circular structure into the center, he started to freak out, and he had to leave. He got out. That's how sensitive some people are to it. I'm an insensitive bastard. I don't feel any of that stuff. And maybe this is why I can deal with these places and go in there and spend hours in there and do the research. And so that's what started happening first. And that obviously started to raise some interesting flags, saying, why are people responding like this? And not just one or two, but dozens, if not hundreds. And then we accidentally, and I don't even recall how this happened. Oh, we must have been trying to figure out the alignment, of the site. And we took a GPS inside, into Adam's calendar. And we found out that the GPS stops to work. It doesn't work.
Wow.
So, and then, we go inside into the calendar, and realize the GPS is scrambling. It's going completely berserk. It's just going crazy. And then you step outside, and it calms down. It shows you exactly where you are. And you take a step or two forward, back into the calendar, and it goes crazy. And I realized there's something else going on here. So, and then what happened then is that was verified by a guy that in my absence came and did some measurements with one of the local journalists that was here living in our small one-horse town called Waterfall-Burfen. In fact, I moved here shortly after meeting Johan and realizing that, the next 10 years of my life is going to be consumed researching the ruins and writing about it and connecting the dots. And I was obviously very accurate in my assumptions or prediction, because I'm still here, and we're right in the heart of what is the largest ancient metropolis or giant settlement or giant something of these ancient ruins, right in the heart of it. And then, so this guy came and this journalist took him to some of the stone ruins, and he had this very advanced device that he could measure sound frequencies, electromagnetic fields running vertically, horizontally. He could measure the sound intensity in decibels, and a bunch of other measurements that this device could measure. And he flipped out. He couldn't believe what he started to measure. Because he comes from the satellite installation field, the guys that work satellites and satellite communication.
Okay.
And so he has a really high knowledge of all that kind of stuff and how to measure it and how to do the various calculations to convert the one measurement to another. And he freaked out. He couldn't believe what he was measuring. And when I got back from my American tour, I think this was in 2010, I heard about this, and I called him up, and I said, listen, I believe you did some interesting measurements. And he said, yeah, man, you won't believe this. And he started telling me what he was measuring. And at that stage, I was already suspecting that there was something else going on, because the stone circles didn't make any sense to me. Although they are, and this is now, I'm going to throw a real curveball at you, and some of your listeners might be aware of this. They thought, all our history books believe that there are a few thousand of these ruins. The largest number estimate was 20,000. Well, when I started counting these ruins, writing temples of the African gods, or the new version of it, the upgraded version that was released, the African temples of the Anunnaki.
Right.
When I started writing that, I did a calculation, and I found that they weren't just a few thousand, that there were actually more than 10 million of these ruins.
Oh, my God.
10 million ruins. Now, Cliff, the moment you see that kind of number come up, you first of all, you think you've made a mistake. So, you go over the calculations again and again, and you go, okay, my goodness, I did not make a mistake. This is how many there are. So what's going on here? And the first thing that hits you is that if there are more than 10 million of these ancient ruins, it means there is truly a vast vanished civilization that we know nothing about, that once lived and flourished here at the southern tip of Africa. Yeah. And it covers literally the whole southern tip of Africa, which is South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe, parts of Mozambique, and from my understanding, it goes across the Zambezi River from Zimbabwe into Zambia as well. But most of it is concentrated in South Africa and Zimbabwe.
Okay.
And that's where it really starts to hit home, and you start to discover important sites like Great Zimbabwe, which is one of the grandest ancient ruins in the world. And it's only when you've been there do you realize how impressive it is. You know, it rivals any of the great ruins that you find in Egypt, in the East, in Mexico. Great Zimbabwe is spectacular.
Okay.
For all kinds of other reasons than megalithic building.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a spectacular story. So I started realizing that these 10 million stone structures didn't make any sense, because no two were the same. Everyone was completely unique in its structure.
Hmm.
And the fact that they didn't have doors and entrances suddenly started something else is going on here. And then I made the discovery by accident again. You know, I accidentally picked up one of the stones, and we were clearing one of the ruins, and the guys were moving the stones. And as they were moving the stones, I heard them putting them down. And it was like listening to like this giant xylophone or marimba playing.
Mm.
I went, oh my goodness, this is like a musical instrument. These stones ring like bells. And at that moment, everything changed, because I realized we're dealing with sound as one of the components of these structures. And sound was one of the driving forces behind it.
Okay. Can you describe a little bit about what your theory is on why these buildings would be built with these stones that are either cut in a certain way or selected in a certain way that give them properties of sound or sound frequency?
Well, most of them aren't even cut. However, let me just correct myself immediately there, because you know, some of the geologists that I had here that were actually a little bit more open-minded looked at some of the stones in the early days, and they just shook their heads and they said, look, these stones don't make any sense to me. They don't look like they were chiseled or shaped or fragmented. It looks like they were molded into the shape.
Hmm.
You know, and for a geologist to say that kind of thing is, you know, you got to push them a long way.
Yeah.
And at that stage, I'd already picked up a few tools and artifacts, and I started assembling what then became my museum. And I found that by accident, again, when I put one of the stones down and it made this amazing ringing sound, I picked it up and I started hitting it with another stone. I realized, oh my goodness, these stones ring like bells. And as I said, you know, people that know this research now will be aware of this. And you can go onto YouTube and just put in stones that ring like bells, and you see a little compilation of me ringing the various stones in my museum. And truly, if you close your eyes, you'll never in your million years guess that I'm hitting stones.
Hmm.
They sound like pieces of metal. So this is what really began to prick my interest. And at that stage, we also started discovering petroglyphs or carvings in rock near these stone circles that were actually images of the stone circles nearby. And this just blew my mind.
Hmm.
And so the question was, well, wow, they were carving the images of these stone circles into these rocks, and you can see in the carvings on the rocks, you can see that these stone circles have no doors and entrances. It's very obvious as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it all started falling into place, because of my, you know, obsession with sound and resonance and frequency, but specifically sound, and my fascination with cymatics and the, you know, the whole study of sound manifesting different shapes and forms, like when you put sand on a metal plate and you put it on a speaker underneath a metal plate and you put play different sounds and frequencies. Mm-hmm. The sand or the rice or whatever you put on top creates these beautiful patterns, unique patterns, and every frequency, every sound has a very unique shape and a pattern to it. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized, when I started looking at patterns of sound or patterns in sand, cymatic photographs of sand on a metal plate, and I started looking at the stone circles, I went, oh my goodness, the stone circles are cymatic patterns. But the pebbles of sand are just stones. They're just much larger versions of these little, you know, sand on a metal plate shapes.
Okay.
And that's where it started to fall into place. And the sound frequencies that we measured just corroborated that, because now we understood that what these stone circles actually are energy generating devices as a result of the amplification factor by piling the stones along the cymatic shape, the shape of the sound that comes out of the earth at that specific point. Mm-hmm. The stones are piled along that shape, so it then amplifies the frequency as it comes out of the earth at that specific point. And the sound frequencies that it then amplifies, because they are deafening, and we're measuring sound frequencies inside the stone circles of I think the lowest we've measured is 11.5 gigahertz, up to over 35 gigahertz inside sound frequencies coming out of these stone walls.
Okay.
Inside the circles, nothing outside, only on the inside. And so that's irrefutable evidence that the stone circles are amplifying the resonance of Mother Earth. The stones are put in place in the shape that there's actually the cymatic pattern that corresponds to that sound frequency. And then those frequencies seem to create a circular motion inside and create these electromagnetic fields. And there you have really what we're dealing with now. And we have free energy devices, more than 10 million free energy devices that give us insane amount of energy every second of the day. We just need to find a way of how to tap into that energy.
So these are all natural structures that were built. Somebody understood the natural frequencies of the earth, the Anunnaki or whoever the builders were. And so, yep. How did they channel all this massive amount of energy? What did they do with that? Was that used to power something, or what's your hypothesis?
Yeah, that's really important and a critical question that we don't really have any concrete answers to. We have some ideas and theories based on some evidence, and some theories based on hypotheses. At this stage, there's no doubt that they were using a lot of this energy for mining gold, because there's the number of ancient gold mines here is spectacular. We're probably way more than a million gold mines here. Mm-hmm. Ancient gold mines, most of which would be covered and gone, but we also have technology to detect underground tunnels, so we know that this whole part of the world is just riddled with ancient tunnels. And many of the tunnels are filled with interesting things that I don't really want to talk about, because it might cause the wrong kind of stampede.
You know, I want to jump into slave species, because our time is moving very quickly here, and this is a fascinating subject. In Adam's calendar, the ruin, you claim that it's at least 75,000 years old, very similar in format or template structure to Stonehenge, but most importantly, the African shaman of the area consider it the birthplace of the sun. They call it the birthplace of the sun. Is it possible that some of that energy that is coming out of these ruins, these circular shapes, and by the way, in your book, you have you diagram some of these shapes as it could be reactors of some kind.
Yes,
which is
very much so.
Quite unique that you bring that up. You show the way that they're designed, that the way they could channel energy may not only intensify the natural geometric fields, geomagnetic fields, excuse me, but yeah, maybe they're being sent somewhere that we don't even know about. Maybe they're still operational. And I want you to talk a little more about the importance of Adam's calendar, because that seems like quite a unique place. And then we're going to jump into some stuff. Yeah.
Oh, it is. You know, the interesting thing, as I mentioned earlier about Adam's calendar, in the stone circles, we measure these incredible frequencies and electromagnetic fields. Mm-hmm. And once again, most of those electromagnetic fields in the stone circles seem to run horizontally. And when you will go in there, you also lose GPS signal. It's not as evident and not as obvious as at Adam's calendar, but you also lose GPS signal in there. But at Adam's calendar, you have no stone walls around you, around the periphery. And yet, the sound frequencies at Adam's calendar are several hundred times stronger than any of the stone circles. Hmm. You know, the highest, as I said, the highest frequency was about 35 gigahertz. And the Adam's calendar frequencies are beyond 375 gigahertz, so it's 10 times stronger than the strongest stone circles we measured.
Wow.
And we don't know. It goes, the measurement was still, it was going up when the machine could no longer, you know, give us accurate measurements. It was just too high. So Adam's calendar is critical, and I do suspect that it was the flagship among these millions of stone circles and these stone ruins, being frequency or energy generators, and they were somehow beaming or broadcasting their energy to Adam's calendar, that was then activated and did something. Now, the interesting thing at Adam's calendar is that there you have two interacting magnetic fields. You have a horizontal one and a vertical one, electromagnetic fields. And it creates like a toroid, a double toroid vortex field. And that is just spectacular. And that's really where the really leading edge, you know, scientists get very excited about this kind of stuff. Because when you start talking about toroids and vortex fields, that's when you start getting the attention of all the really leading edge scientists around the world today. And when they see the measurements we've taken there, you know, I'm in discussion now with people that are developing alternative energy devices. You know, probably 20 different people around the world that not only have theories but have created these devices and are sharing it in various ways, and are threatened and manipulated by various other, you know, groups and corporations and so forth, as you know, the case is and has been for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it's just literally, Adam's calendar is a spectacular sight. It is unlike anything else I've seen, other than what I show in my presentations of what I've now concluded are some of the ancient temples in Egypt. You know, they were actually also what these stone ruins in Southern Africa are silicon-based technology, because that's what we're dealing with.
Right.
We're dealing with metamorphosized quartzite, quartz crystal, crystalline quartz structures, and the quartz and the activity of the quartz, the vibration and the resonance of the quartz is actually what's used in creating all these energy fields. And so we're dealing with silicon-based technology. The most advanced technology we use today. The reason you and I can communicate is because of silicon-based technology.
Right.
The way we're doing this interview right now, right? Mm-hmm. So, and when you start looking at the ancient temples in Egypt, you realize that they're not temples or for worshipping or anything, but they actually are giant templates for circuit boards. Giant circuit boards. They were also just silicon-based technology and circuit boards on a gigantic scale that we couldn't even imagine until you start seeing them from the air, and you realize, oh my goodness, this is very different from what we thought it was. Mm-hmm. For those people interested, just look up one of my presentations online, and you can see some of those images that I'm referring to that give it it's a dead giveaway. Once you see it, it changes your entire perspective on those. So that now ties into Adam's calendar and the measurements we've taken here and the fact that it's so active, still so active, even in such a bad state of disrepair. It is still so active. You can just imagine how much energy it must have created when it was truly in, you know, in place and really, new.
Mm-hmm. So you stumbled on a silicon-based technology that is hundreds or thousands of years in advance of to our current knowledge, based on some science of the cosmos, and this could be a universal science, because in my study of the Maya, they actually imbued information in a lot of their temples and pyramids. We don't have we don't have technology that can decode or extrapolate that information yet. All we can do is measure it in terms of high frequency vibrations, be it sound or a frequency that we can sense physically. But is it your belief that at some point in our evolution we will create a tool, a measuring device that actually can decode these vibrations and be able to give us the actual information that's in these stones?
Yes. I've been joking about that in my lectures. You know, I've been saying jokingly that very soon some 12-year-old kid's going to walk up to Stonehenge or Adam's Calendar or the Great Pyramid with his iPhone and plug the latest app in and shove it into one of the stones and download some weird information that none of us understand, but it'll download. Because remember, all these ancient structures are machines. They're giant machines, silicon-based technology, that are driven, activated by the sun, the light of the sun, and the light frequencies and the sound frequencies associated with the sun. This is why they are aligned with the solstices, the equinoxes. So when the sun rises in this point, it hits the structure in a certain angle, and it activates it, just like when you hit your key on your keyboard. It's an activation. Different keys activate different things. It's silicon-based technology, activated by sound, light, and frequency. Mm-hmm. Same thing. These ancient ruins, from the pyramids to Adam's calendar to Stonehenge specifically, it's a great example. Borobudur, when you look at Borobudur from the air, oh my goodness, you can see the resonance encoded in it. And so these are all giant machines that are built to perform some specific function. It's at that point that we start to not understand what function it's supposed to perform, or we start to theorize about it. And I must tell you is that it's silicon-based technology, right? And it is encoded. Remember that we can now store digital data in quartz crystal, mm-hmm. in silicon.
Right.
And so incredible amount of information can be stored in a tiny little silicon chip. Pure quartz crystal, mm-hmm. Trillions of terabytes of information, and when you start dealing with crystal and water, the two most abundant substances on Earth, water and silica, sand, quartz, right? pretty much all the rock in the world, all the stone has quartz in it, silica, mm-hmm. And you start realizing that all these ancient sites are encoded, like you said, with advanced knowledge and information. And sooner or later, as I said, we will be able to plug in and download that information and decode it. But that is connected to our level of consciousness. And unfortunately, I believe that until our collective consciousness rises to a certain level as the human race, and we start to understand our place in the universe, historically, physically, spiritually, until we reach those higher levels of consciousness, we're not going to we're not going to have access to that. It's protected, and it is. You know, we're coming out of this state of infantile ignorance as a species, that is not necessarily through evolution, but through manipulation and by design that we are so ignorant and so naive and so stupid.
Okay.
So, and that becomes very evident when you start looking at structures like Adam's calendar, this advanced technology, and these millions of energy devices in Southern Africa that were channeling all this energy for something. These giant circuit boards in Egypt that were manipulating all kinds of things, and it all leads to certain interesting conclusions that they were manipulating our atmosphere, manipulating, possibly generating an atmosphere, mm-hmm. creating different climatic structures, geoengineering, terraforming. Oh my goodness, it can go to so many different things. Some of the conclusions I've been reaching lately in from some of the stone structures in Southern Africa is that they resemble the internal structure of your lungs, the alveoli, the trachea, your larynx and the trachea, and then the little pipes that get smaller and smaller in your lungs until they reach the alveoli themselves. And when you start looking at these aerial stone ruins, they look identical to the tissue and the alveoli in your lungs.
Hmm.
And that started made me realize that we're learning. Well, I'm learning so much from studying these ancient cultures and these stone ruins. I'm learning so much. If you let your mind expand and just let the information come to you, it's completely mind-blowing. Because it now seems that, first of all, the sound that we make when we breathe the air into our lungs, it is not just the air that we breathe into our lungs, but it is the sound of the air that we breathe in, and the speed of the sound at which it enters our lungs that keeps to increase. It speeds up and speeds up until the air itself and the sound of the air as it goes through our trachea into our bronchi and to alveoli. That sound reaches hypersound levels. Now, many of mainstream scientists would probably have never heard the word hypersound. And hypersound is a really advanced knowledge and understanding of sound and what happens to sound. And the fact that sound can travel beyond the speed of light is one of the best kept secrets in physics and science. Now, at this point, many of your listeners are going to jump up and down and say, oh, Michael Tillinger is an idiot. Sound doesn't travel faster than the speed of light. And they would be wrong. And these are the things that we find. So what I found is talking to these crazy German scientists that made these amazing discoveries about hypersound and what happens to sound at certain speeds and when things convert to hypersound, that's what happens to the air we breathe. And it is the sound and the hypersound of the air we breathe that oxygenates the blood. That is the methodology by which we get energy into our bloodstream. Now, I can tell you right now, I was never taught this at medical school, okay? I was taught every other bit of BS except this.
Yeah. Okay. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So now, when I start, I've already shared with you that the stone circles are resonating devices. They resonate and they create incredible amounts of energy and sound energy, which turn into electromagnetic fields and other forms of energy. Mm-hmm. So when you start seeing stone circles that resemble the lungs and the alveoli, you start going, oh my God, what were these guys doing? They were using the sound frequencies to turn it into hypersound, the sound frequencies from Mother Earth, to turn it into hypersound, to possibly, geoengineer, create a different atmosphere, create new elements in the atmosphere? What were they doing with this hypersound structured stone circles?
It's amazing.
It is mind-blowing stuff. It is really, it's a process. You got to just keep your mind open.
I want to touch on a couple of areas, and then we're getting close to the conclusion here, but in your book, you describe the importance of gold. Now, not just standard gold ore, but white powder of gold. Why?
Yeah.
And you actually describe what you believe was an application, a physical application of this white powder and its ability to enhance the human body. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're touching upon a few very important connectors there. Gold being described by shaman around the world mm-hmm. as the blood or the arteries of Mother Earth that resonate the true consciousness of our planet and contain a lot of very important energies. And they're like arteries throughout the planet. So when we take the gold out of the ground, we actually rob Mother Earth of some very important energetic. It's like taking the blood out of our body.
Okay.
Right? But it comes down to monoatomic elements and gold in its monoatomic form, or white powder of gold, or manna from heaven, and many other names that have been given. I think the Egyptians called it muftak. Meaning what is it, and William Henry has done amazing research and work on that in that area. So when you start looking at the monoatomic elements, it changes all our perspective about the laws of nature of reality, the physics that we know, and we have to start looking at the stuff around us, the seen and the unseen stuff, in multidimensional physics and not in the physics that we are taught at school. And this is where, unfortunately, a lot of the mainstream academics fall off the wagon, and they just, you know, because they've never heard of it, they think it's, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And unfortunately, again, they'd be wrong. We know very, very much what we're talking about, and there's been an insane amount of research and knowledge passed on about this. But as we know, the mainstream universities are not going to teach this stuff, because that gives you all the information they're trying to withhold from our textbooks. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to find it in the textbooks. Yeah. And so the monoatomic elements are critical to us as conscious beings, to the elevation of our consciousness, to the activation of certain of our physiological and anatomical features, activating our DNA, healing and curing all disease, because it brings brings us into balance and in harmony and coherence with planet Earth. And because if you're not in coherence with a prime resonance frequency, which is our planet, which needs to be in coherence with the solar system, which needs to be in coherence with the galaxy, if it's not, then it's in dissonance, and then it's in dis-ease, and that's when you become sick, when you're in disease.
Mm-hmm.
So you start realizing how critical some of this ancient knowledge was, and why they were using monoatomic elements for their own health and for their own keeping sane and raising their consciousness levels and so forth. And we only really scratching the bottom of the barrel in that knowledge pool right now. Some people claim they know a lot more, but I think there's still a lot more to be found. However, there is also the sinister side of this, and this is where I start getting, you know, into the whole Anunnaki agenda. And for people that still don't know who the Anunnaki are, boy, are you behind the times. Go out there and do some research, because the Anunnaki and the Elohim, the biblical Elohim, most likely the same group of beings, and that's where a lot of the distortion and the lies and deceptions and the control mechanisms have been enforced on humanity.
Mm.
And when you take the L out of gold, you get God. Elohim made themselves the gods. And for those people that still, you know, read the Bible and believe it word for word, please don't do that. Although it is filled with advanced knowledge beyond your wildest imagination, what we've been told as the important parts of the Bible are all the lies and deceptions. The real juicy stuff is between the lines. That's where you find all the advanced knowledge and information. And the key thing is that, you know, the Elohim in the Bible is a plural word, plural for El, the gods. So every time you read the word God in the Bible, understand that you're actually meaning the true Hebrew meaning for that is Elohim and the gods, and not multiple and not singular. Very important.
Okay.
So the Anunnaki are most likely these beings that enforce themselves and impose themselves on the species that they created as their slave species to help them mine the gold. And they used this gold not in its yellow, shiny form, but in the monatomic form that was probably taken off this planet and continues to be taken off this planet. And then you start getting some interesting sinister activity, and this is where the important work of someone like oh my goodness, now I have a complete block on his name, from Phoenix, Arizona, David Hudson,
okay,
with his amazing breakthrough research in the 80s, early 80s already, when he started researching the white powder of gold, monatomic form of gold, and he realized that this white fluffy powder, when a gold atom, AU1, not AU2, a single atom of gold, before it binds to itself to form the stable yellow kind of gold that we know, it's not actually yellow, it's black, but before the AU can bind to itself, and it binds to something else, or if it doesn't bind, if you keep it in a state of inert gas, in a state of non-binding, it creates this white fluffy powder that has got no metallic properties. It starts to display just ridiculous properties that are not part of our physical understanding of the laws of physics.
Hmm.
It's devoid of gravity. It floats. It, when you put your hand under it, it rises up. It doesn't respond to magnets or electrical currents, but it responds to the energy in your body. And that's where you start seeing how important these monatomic elements were in ancient times.
Okay.
Yeah, look, we can talk for hours and days about this. There's so much information.
Yes.
This is why certain smells that make you feel good have monatomic elements that induce a possible hypnotic state that expands your mind and allows you to connect to the higher realms, where you start looking at the structure of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, and the hallucinogenic drugs, and the morphine, and the pethidine kind of drugs that are pentagonal structures connected to hexagonal structures, and you realize that all this stuff is, the ancients knew all this stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason of that they have certain effects on us, moving from the physical to the spiritual, from the five factor, from the five sided structure to the six sided structure, the spirit side. And the numeric values 5 and 6, it just becomes such an interesting study, Cliff. But this is why, you know, when you talk to historians and archaeologists about this stuff, and you start getting into this kind of knowledge of advanced physics, science, multidimensional physics, as opposed to guys that dig for bones in the ground, you know, unfortunately, there's very little connection there, you know?
they cannot relate.
No.
Listen, we're down to a few minutes. I want you to talk a little bit about your latest work with the Ubuntu project, and yes. it all kind of connects. I think you brought it up earlier that we're not ready as a species to really understand this technology that you have discovered, because we're not either in an evolutionary place or we have been dealt with the evil of having to live and work and have to suffer under rules of monetization in life. That's a big problem here in America, where we're a marketing society. You know, what's the latest thing you've purchased? What do you got that the Joneses don't have? This and that kind of lifestyle. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit
We're not human beings, Cliff. We are consumers.
Yeah, exactly.
We're referred to as consumers.
Right. And that's your point in saying that because our mindset is in such a way that we are a consumer nation, the subtleties of this technology that was left to us thousands and thousands of years ago isn't made available, because our consciousness isn't set in that way so that we can observe it. And only a few of us, like yourself, are picking up on this technology, either through being sensitive to it or just tripping upon it and going, oh my God, this is a technology that we can detect, but we cannot download. We're not ready to download it. So why don't you go ahead and talk about Ubuntu and what you're up to with that, and then we'll continue.
Yeah, very, very simply. Thanks very much. Because that, you know, my latest book, Ubuntu Contributionism, A Blueprint for Human Prosperity, mm-hmm. it's available in the USA. It's available in German now as well. It's available in Croatian. I'm hoping to get a Spanish translation soon. It's just gone crazy around the world, and it really is exactly that. It's a blueprint for human prosperity because of what we've learned from the ancient civilizations. And we've learned that we can't continue living the way we are today. Clearly, the socio-economic or socio-political structure we find ourselves in has not worked. For thousands of years, we've tried the same things over and over again. And the center of this thousands of years of experiment is money. What I found writing Slave Species of God, I realized that there was a time in ancient times where money did not exist. And then you stumble upon some Sumerian texts that talk about these ancient priest kings who were appointed by the gods to rule over humanity, and these ancient priest kings who became, you know, the stooges for the Anunnaki and the gods in ancient times, were given certain knowledge and powers and knowledge of alchemy and sorcery and so forth, with which and given obviously some fierce weapons as well, with which they could control the people and rule over the people. And so this is where you suddenly see the appearance of the royal bloodlines, which we still have today. The royalty bloodlines today are the descendants of these first royalty priest kings that we read about in the Sumerian texts, very well-known kings, known as the kings lists. No one can deny it. It's not something I'm making up. It's well, you know, well-researched, well-translated, well-accepted, even by the mainstream academia in this case. But they just haven't been able to figure out what this all means or put it into context. Mm-hmm. So you suddenly realize that there was a time, and these first priest kings became the first bankers. They issued the first money in the forms of Sumerian clay tablets. Mm. And the temples were the first banks. And nothing has changed. The banking families today still have the exclusive rights to create money out of thin air, out of nothing, and issue it to the people of the, all the different countries of the world, and control the printing and the creation of money, with which they enslave every single one of us. So that led me to the very obvious conclusion that money it was created as a tool of enslavement that was maliciously introduced to the human race to control humanity. It just replaces. Money is a form of enslavement that replaces the whips and the chains, the physical enslavement. Mm-hmm. It becomes a different kind of enslavement. You still work for your master, but you just become ignorant. You know, you think you have the freedom. It's the illusion of freedom, but you still have to work for the master, and they own all the land and they own the entire planet. Mm. So I created this philosophy based on the ancient philosophy of Ubuntu, which is unity within community, where everybody works together for the greatest benefit of all, rather working in cooperation instead of in competition, which is a capitalistic device to divide people and separate people as opposed to uniting people. Now, when you start cooperating instead of competing, everything becomes available to everyone. And I've coined a phrase which has now become accepted in more than 215 countries around the world, which I call contributionism, where people work together and they contribute their God-given talents and skills towards the greater benefit of all in their community. Mm. And that's what we're building here right now in our little town of Waardevolbuffen. We're putting in the foundations of what we call the first contributionism community, and I must tell you, it is blowing my mind. 2 years ago, I never would have believed how people would respond to this. In our little town where there's 70 to 80% unemployment, how all the youth, especially the young black youth in the townships, they have nothing, how they are standing behind me and rallying behind this philosophy. And slowly but surely, we're implementing a number of community projects in which people come and work and participate and lay the foundations for what will become a community of abundance. Very, very soon, within 12 to 24 months, there'll be so much abundance in every possible area, from bread to bricks to bridges to science and technology, beyond our wildest imagination.
So is it a barter system that you created where people barter, trade?
No.
Okay.
No, you do what most people do, and it's understandable. But remember, a barter system is just another form of control. Mm-hmm. He who has nothing to trade, what are you going to trade if you have nothing to barter?
Okay.
So you can't have a barter system. That's why it's called contributionism. Everybody has some skills and talents. Everybody has a passion. And everybody has time on their hands. Everybody has they can do something. So, and there are people that are great scientists. There are people that are good food growers. There are people that are good, you know, technology developers, and people that love to work with cows, and people that love to bake bread. So there's a different passion and an obsession for every person that we have. No two people have the same passion. Everyone has a slightly different spin on what they'd really like to do.
Right.
So all you got to do is tap into those unique talents of, and this is what they tell us in the Bible, your talents, your God-given talents, your talents that you're born with. Right, that's what you got to put to use. But we work on the philosophy of producing an alternative source of electricity, and that alternative source of electricity, which is free to the people, and we have those sources of electricity now. Not that, you know, we're not still dreaming about it. We have them. And once everybody has free electricity, in return for that free electricity, they contribute 3 hours a week towards one of the community projects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can imagine, in a community of 1,000 people, that's 3,000 hours a week. You have to have a lot of community projects just to put the people to work.
Yeah.
So it's not something that's just going to happen on a Saturday morning or Sunday morning. It happens every day, all day. You're going to have to put people to work in one of the community projects.
Mm-hmm.
So in our little town, we've now started this. We've got 23 different community projects that we've started to launch. From the obvious, the dairy, the bakery, the metal factory, the wood factory, the brick making, to fish farming, to mushroom growing, to food growing, and you can imagine, let your mind run wild. That's now become possible.
Hmm.
And it's blowing my mind. It's and the way we are starting this in our community is, we are refurbishing a badly vandalized and dilapidated community hall, and that's now becoming the new heart of this Ubuntu contributionism community.
Okay.
And in return for going and working for 3 hours in one of the community projects, you come to the town hall where we've now put a food kitchen, what we call the Ubuntu Community Kitchen. And in return for working for 3 hours, you come and have a nice meal, have a glass of lemonade and a cup of coffee or tea, and then in the evening you can watch a movie. All of this in return for working for 3 hours in one of the community projects.
Wow.
So this is how we put the people that are homeless or don't have any jobs, and as like I said, 70% unemployment. So there are a lot of people with nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now they suddenly find a purpose in life. Not only that, they're learning new skills, because we're bringing in volunteers from all over the world that are master carpenters and master food growers and mm-hmm. and experts in different areas of different fields. So